I'm Jim Benson, and you're listening to TV Time Machine on Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and visit our show archives at tvtimemachine.com.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Ladies and gentlemen, you're about to embark on a journey through a vast galaxy that traverses memory, generations, and popular culture. A magical trip through time as we meet the men and women of yesterday and today who have shaped not only what we see on TV, but the way we see ourselves. I'm Jim Benson. Join me, if you will, on an exploration of television's past, present, and future as we climb aboard the TV Time Machine. Our destination subjects today will be the classic film about the television industry, Network, and Alan Thicke, the star of the new comedy reality show, Unusually Thicke. New York Times culture reporter and author of the book Mad as Hell, Dave Itzkoff, and actor-comedian Alan Thicke will join us for a fascinating journey exploring two very different dimensions of television. We'll begin our exciting and fun-filled odyssey right after these brief messages.
I was born Mary Tyler Moore.
Is Jesse Donald Knotts.
Fred McFeely Rogers.
Leslie Moonves.
Isabel Sanford.
Leslie Renee Stahl.
Robert Edward Turner.
Regis Francis Philbin.
Aaron Spelling.
Since 1999, the Archive of American Television has been preserving the memories, knowledge, and insights of the men and women whose talents and vision have helped shape this remarkable medium. Over 500 video interviews with these TV legends are now available on the Archive of American Television website at metvlegends.org. There you can sign up to receive news, updates, and also become a sponsor to help preserve television history for generations to come. That's metvlegends.org.
The mythological proportions of Star Trek provide something that's missing in people's consciousness, psyche.
The Archive of American Television. Capturing television history, one voice at a time.
I would like at this moment to announce that I will be retiring from this program in 2 weeks' time because of poor ratings. Since this show was the only thing I had going for me in my life, I have decided to kill myself. I'm going to blow my brains out right on this program a week from today.
Today on the TV Time Machine, we are proud to welcome Dave Itzkoff, the author of Mad as Hell, The Making of Network, and The Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. Mr. Itzkoff is a culture reporter for the New York Times and was previously associate editor at Spin Magazine and Maxim. Over the next segment, Dave Itzkoff will help us explore virtually every aspect of writer Paddy Chayefsky's classic 1976 film Network and the movie's amazing prescience about the future of television. Again, for those of you intrepid enough to be mad as hell, feel free to yell out the window as we look from the present to a past that has already predicted our present. Dave, thank you for coming on board the TV Time Machine.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Now, you're the author of the book Mad as Hell, The Making of Network, and The Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. Dave, tell us what Mad as Hell explores, and what inspired you to write this book at this time?
Sure. Well, the book is about not only the making of the film Network and, you know, its creation and what it had to say about television and media in the era that the film was released in 1976, but, I mean, it's also, I hope, a deep dive sort of into the life and the career of Paddy Chayefsky, who was, you know, not only the film's screenwriter, but really its driving force and, you know, what motivated him to pursue it. And also a look at, you know, why it mattered that he worked so hard to get the film made the way that it was, because it turned out to be sort of incredibly, you know, prescient in anticipating what the media environment of the present day was going to look like, and sort of, you know, the period that Chayefsky lived through, where in some ways he, you know, had to sort of endure an era where, you know, the film itself was almost sort of mocked for being so outlandish, and that he never actually lived to see a lot of these prophecies come true.
Now, when you first saw Network, how did it affect you?
You know, it's something that I would have to really think back on, because what I don't remember as vividly as seeing for the first time is, you know, reading a Mad Magazine parody of Network, which was called Nutwork.
Right.
And I remember, you know, that it had... you know, a lot of, like, you know, bleeped out curse words. Like, the parody was sort of making fun of the fact that, you know, there was so much swearing in the movie, and it had all these kind of funny little symbols and characters representing the curse words.
Right.
So that's what made me want to seek it out as, you know, probably a 7 or 8 year old. And then I probably re-encountered it as an adult, I'm sure, in college or just thereafter.
Well, the 1950s are typically referred to as the golden age of television. Tell us what Paddy Chayefsky's contribution was to the golden age.
Yeah, I mean, it's, in some ways, it's almost sort of hard to, you know, overstate what he did for TV, because in that period, the medium was so new and so sort of alien to a lot of people. And, you know, movies, of course, you know, still dominated. And he became, you know, truly one of the first name brand writers on TV, at least in the sense that, you know, people associated him with his, you know, people who, you know, were looking maybe more at, you know, what actors were in a show or who directed it, that people came to actually look for things because Paddy Chayefsky wrote them. And you know, his big breakthrough, I think, as most people will know, was Marty, which started out as a teleplay and is the story of, you know, a butcher in the Bronx who's sort of middle-aged and lonely and very lovelorn. That, of course, started out not as a TV drama, but then was adapted into the film starring Ernest Borgnine that went on to win Best Picture and won Chayefsky his first screenwriting Oscar. So it gave him, you know, a tremendous amount of credibility and standing in the industry. It also, you know, legitimized TV as this kind of, you know, a vehicle for, you know, true dramatic storytelling. And, it, you know, not only for general audiences, but the movie industry itself began looking more closely at TV instead of just sort of dismissing it out of hand, sort of saying, how can we tap into it and how can we perhaps exploit that?
And Marty and Paddy Chayefsky's characters were unique because they were real people.
Well, that's exactly that. I mean, this is all sort of coming out of the era, let's say, of, you know, plays like Death of a Salesman, which came out in, you know, 1949, and this whole sort of reassessment of what constitutes proper drama, and the idea that, you know, all these kind of these seemingly, you know, middle class and working class people could be vehicles for, you know, for powerful drama. You didn't have to solely focus, let's say, on the kings and historical figures of Shakespeare.
So what is a typical Paddy Chayefsky character? What are they usually trying to convey?
Well, they tend, by and large, to be people who are very wound up, you know, pent up people who are kind of overlooked in their particular field or their personal, their private life. Basically, who aren't given a chance to express themselves fully, and then they almost always get one moment, you know, usually in the climactic part of the story, where they just kind of explode. Everything that has been built up in them gets to kind of come loose in, you know, one big passionate blurt, usually in the form of an angry speech.
So, what events led Paddy Chayefsky out of television and toward the stage and feature films?
Well, it was a combination of the success that he enjoyed, which was opening up all these new arenas for him, but also a kind of continued frustration on his part that he felt that he wasn't ever really getting the level of control over his writing that he felt that he deserved, particularly in TV. When that started out, his feeling was that the writer was sort of the worst treated person on any production, that you wrote something, you turned it in, and then, you know, your producers and directors and whomever could do whatever they pleased with it. So his move, you know, from TV into film, it was partly, you know, for more money, more prestige, but also, at least for a brief period of time, the belief that he would have more control over the scripts that he wrote. Then when he goes from film into the live theater, again, it has a lot to do with a desire for control. Theater in particular, I mean, as much as he worked in that, I think he got beat up on quite a bit in his reviews and in the press. For as many years as he worked on his plays, I think that really stung him, and that eventually drives him back to TV for a little while, that he tries pitching, you know, new TV ideas in the 60s and 70s. One of those pitches eventually becomes his screenplay for The Hospital. That wins him his second Oscar. And astoundingly, at that point, he really could do almost anything that he wanted. He's now got two Academy Awards, you know, by the mid-70s, plenty of years presumably left in him. And that's also the period when he seemed to struggle most, that, you know, all these ideas that he was coming up with and things that were fully developed, written, just could not get made. He was having trouble with different screenplay ideas, different TV shows, one that went all the way to pilot and then was not picked up. And I think that was a particularly, frustrating period for him.
So ironically, he basically came back with a movie about television, Network. What was the genesis of Network?
Well, you know, the movie went through quite a bit of evolution and development within him, and a lot of writing and rewriting. The one idea that he always sort of had in mind was that there would be some kind of instigating incident where a television news anchor would just kind of snap on air and start either spouting gibberish or go on a very kind of pointed political rant, and that would be the sort of flashpoint moment, and that would not only have these, a lot of effects and falling out within the world of that anchor and what happens to his news show, but that would then give you a way to explore the larger world of the TV network, all the different ramifications and the ways that that would shake out within the TV organization, and that would let him take on all these larger ideas that he wanted to tackle, everything from the corporatization of America and the way that American companies are getting bought up by larger international conglomerates, to ideas about alienation and corruption and his feeling that Americans were very isolated from one another and were so sort of bound up in this technology that was moving and changing so rapidly and really just sort of disconnecting people from one another.
So ultimately, what was he trying to say with Network? What was he tapping into socially at the time?
Well, I think there was really quite a bit that he was trying to take on, in fact. He was the sort of person, he was a very anxious guy in general and had a pretty healthy paranoid streak, and he was so attuned to a lot of problems that were going on not only in the country but around the world. And if you think about Howard Beale's Mad as Hell speech and all the things that he's complaining about in that moment, where he's talking about the depression and the inflation and the punks running wild in the streets and the guns and the crime, these were all things that in some form or another were preying upon Chayefsky's mind, that he really was afraid of all these things that were plaguing America. He was also very concerned about developments in the Middle East and the idea that somehow there could be another war that would just wipe Israel off the map. And, very paranoid about Arabic countries and Arabic cultures. All these different things kind of swirling around, and also this very strong sort of social conscience that he had, this feeling that in order to be a good writer, it was almost his obligation to have to tell people what else is out there in the world that they need to be aware of and be worried about.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street, and there's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad.
Now, the amazing thing about Network was the assemblage of a perfect cast and crew. Now, starting with director Sidney Lumet, why was he the perfect choice for Network?
Well, Lumet makes a lot of sense in so many ways because, for example, he started out in TV in the same period that Chayefsky did, also came out of that golden age and was one of its truly greatest directors and had a lot of experience with live broadcasts. And he has, in a funny way, a kind of parallel career to Chayefsky's that, you know, he also breaks through via film very quickly when he directs the film version of 12 Angry Men, that also kind of catapults him out of TV and into this larger film career. And certainly by the time Network comes around in the mid-70s, he's also made these kinds of great, you know, New York in total decline movies, films like Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon that are really about its decay and the underbelly of it. And in New York, you don't see it to quite the same degree in Network, but the city is very much a character in the film. It really could not be set anywhere else.
Now, also tell us about William Holden. He played Max Schumacher. Was he Chayefsky's first choice for the role?
Well, he was one of several people that, you know, they were kicking around. I mean, certainly one thing that you learn about this particular process and the casting of movies is that you just can't have your heart set on any one person because either they'll be unavailable or they will turn you down. But Holden was among the few that I think always was sort of on a kind of working wish list. I mean, they were looking at a lot of different people who were kind of, you know, let's say rugged and a little bit craggy and well lived in, people who could play that's kind of a character, a man who was certainly the Max Schumacher character is treated as somebody who was once great in his day, but maybe whose, you know, best moments are behind him. And that's certainly how Holden was regarded in Hollywood at the time. And he had starred not only in things like Golden Boy, but Sunset Boulevard and Stalag 17. But those were all many years behind him, even by the time of Network. And people who remembered him as this kind of handsome marquee idol, I mean, he certainly had not retained that physical shape anymore.
Now, the one person who doesn't quite come off as well in your book, Mad as Hell, is Faye Dunaway. Tell us why she was perfect for her character, but maybe not so perfect to work with.
Well, she's a very complicated figure, as you can imagine, and she'd also had a pretty, you know, tremendous career run even by the time she was cast in Network. But she was much younger. She's only in her mid-30s by the time the movie is made, and then had this period where even while she was continuing to work for almost another decade, the press treated her almost as if she had fallen off the map, that she was working in, you know, more offbeat or just challenging kinds of film projects. And then when Chinatown comes around, suddenly everyone is treating it like, you know, she's on the comeback trail, even though she had never really gone away. But certainly with something like Chinatown and all the battles that she had with director Roman Polanski on that film, I think she starts to get this reputation for just being, very demanding on her directors, very specific in what she wants, expecting to have input into her characters and her performances. And that's something that a lot of directors, and especially male directors, could not countenance in that day. And so she gets this kind of reputation as, kind of a diva. And so it makes her almost ideal to play the character Diana Christensen, because she's supposed to be not only a very hard-charging executive, but she's the lone woman in this completely male-dominated field, and is basically as tough, if not tougher, than the men that she has to come up against. And that a lot, you know, much the same could be said about Dunaway and how she approached her own career.
Now, oddly enough, Howard Beale was the last major character to be cast. How did that happen, and who ultimately got the role?
Well, we of course know that it eventually did go to Peter Finch, but he was nowhere near the top of the sort of wish list of actors that Patty Chayefsky and Sidney Lumet had in mind. And, you know, they started with folks like Paul Newman, who Chayefsky, you know, reached out directly, wrote a personal letter to see if he would consider essentially any character in the script, but really thinking or hoping that that he would tend toward the Beale character, but he passed on it. They also tried to go back to George C. Scott, who had been the star of Chayefsky's film The Hospital, hoping that he might consider Beale, but he made it pretty clearly known that he would only do the film if his wife, Trish Van Devere, could also be in it, and that was pretty much a non-starter. And then just a lot of other, pretty much anyone who was a name in Hollywood in that period, everybody from, you know, Walter Matthau to Jimmy Stewart was on their wish list. You know, how far they got with any of those people is, you know, not entirely clear. But I think for a lot of actors, as much as people respected Chayefsky and respected his writing, there was a very clear sense that this was going to be a very controversial film, and the role itself is going to be... you know, it was going to take a lot of energy, and it was maybe even considered a little bit vulgar, again, just because of all the sort of naughty language in the script. And, you know, that wasn't a position that a lot of actors wanted to put themselves in. So, you know, eventually, Finch is someone, again, who, as I said, was not really ever on their radar, but his, you know, he had gotten an Oscar nomination a few years earlier for Sunday, Bloody Sunday. His manager at the time was a very persistent person and just really, you know, went after Chayefsky and his producing team for, you know, just please at least look at my client. And by the time they got to see him, they had just exhausted, you know, so many other avenues, and that they were really just ready to make a deal on the spot.
We're going to have to take a little break from our fascinating journey, but never fear. We'll be back in a lightning flash with Dave Itzkoff, the author of the book Mad as Hell, The Making of Network, and the fateful vision of the angriest man in movies, who is traveling with us on the TV Time Machine.